We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
A bit loud. What's going on, everybody? Radio Basics. It must be Monday, July 13th. And yeah, coming to you live from CHRY 105.5. So today's show, we're gonna play some interviews of documentary filmmaker Kevin Annett, who made a documentary about residential schools and you know, what went down there in the Canadian state. So we're going to get to that after, but we're going to play a couple tracks right now. So what do we got right now, Dave?
We got Wailing Blues.
By?
By a Res Blues production. It's a bunch of people, not one.
Great show.
Many.
Yeah.
Millions.
Okay, so we're going to kick it off with that. CHRY 105.5, Radio Basics.
Res Blues.
CHRY 105.5. We're back, Radio Basics. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Like I said, we're going to play a documentary today on the residential schools and the Canadian state's involvement with it, the United Church's involvement with it, and you know, a whole host of other players and stuff. And so Kevin Annett, you know, a former minister, defrocked for you know, exposing the crimes of the church. He made a documentary, and it's on Google Videos. It has like thousands and thousands of clips. It's about an hour and 20 minutes long, but you know, it's definitely worth checking out. So before we get to that, we're going to do what we normally do, and that's headlines. So I guess to start it off, the Toronto Star reported that there's a legal aid boycott, which is growing over paltry paychecks. So last fall, in the middle of a schizophrenic breakdown, a 21-year-old man approached a woman in a parking lot in North Toronto and asked for directions. As she began writing out a map, he stabbed her in the neck. Charged with attempted murder, aggravated assault, and weapons charges, the man suddenly facing a maximum penalty under the criminal code, life in prison. Despite the gravity of the charges, Catherine Curry, a Toronto lawyer appointed to represent him, was allowed to spend just 15 paid hours preparing his defense. The billing restrictions imposed by Ontario's embattled legal aid plan. So strict billing caps and meager hourly rates are fueling a rapidly growing legal aid boycott in Ontario. It began on June 1st in Toronto, where more than 300 criminal lawyers stopped accepting legal aid certificates for homicide, guns, and gang cases. Lawyers in Kingston and northwestern Ontario joined the boycott, which in the past week spread to Barrie, Sudbury, and Hamilton. That pushed the number of protesters to more than 400, nearly half of all criminal lawyers in Ontario. So what the gist of this article is, that, poor racialized people that get brought in on different charges can't get access to, you know, a basic provision of justice to defend themselves in a court of law. The Ontario plan strictly says you can only work so many hours preparing the defense, and, you know, I guess the so-called soulless lawyers out there actually do have a soul and are coming together and you know, talking about this injustice and trying to, you know, work against it. Got anything to add, David?
That's bad.
Yeah, it is pretty bad, you know, and especially, like, a lot of our racialized neighborhoods are over-policed, and they're brought in a lot on, you know, charges. Like, just when they do these raids, neighborhood raids, right? Yeah. You have 150 people brought in neighborhoods like Lawrence and Markham Road and all over the place, right? So you can see, and this is a perfect example of systemic racism, I think.
Yeah, well, it shows that justice is for just us, as Big El once said, white kids.
Yeah.
Because obviously racialized communities, they don't have the money to pay for lawyers, and if they're getting lawyers from the state who are only allowed to work a certain amount of hours or given only money for it, then obviously their case is going to be lost.
Yeah, and it's almost government policy not to help them, right? And
let's over-police them and then not help them with their cases.
Exactly. I was talking to someone recently. He said it's, you know, it's a school-to-prison pipeline, insofar as you have police in schools, obviously targeting certain individuals.
Well, they're obviously targeting certain people by being in certain schools and not others, at least this year, and it's
groups
first
of people.
Year.
Yeah, and like, you know, I grew up in a suburb and went to a high school, and man, like, if police were there, they'd make arrests every day. I'm telling you, like, you know, like, possession, you know, weapons, like, but they just didn't come around, so those people never got charged. But in other neighborhoods, right, the cops are right there.
All the time.
Yeah. So that's that. I mean, I could go on and on about this, but I'm going to leave it at that. And Dave, if you got any headlines that, you know,
today. Yeah. Oh, that's a daily occurrence. But not too many things. But one thing, which really is a bunch of malarkey, Obama recently said that Africa needs to stop blaming Western oppression for the continent's manifold problems, essentially saying that neocolonialism and colonialism are not the core issue or reason why that many African countries are not doing very well. As my phone rings, darn it. What did he say? He says, ultimately, I'm a big believer that Africans are responsible for Africa. I think part of what's hampered advancement in Africa is that for many years we've made excuses about corruption or poor governance, that this was somehow the consequence of neocolonialism, or that the West has been oppressive, or racism. I'm not a big fan in or believer in excuses. And then he went on to say, and yet the fact is we're in 2009. The West and the United States has not been responsible for what's happened to Zimbabwe's economy over the last 15 to 20 years. I mean, that it's absurd. I mean, we know the parasitic relationship that the West, and especially U.S. imperialism, has over countries, especially in Africa, with the large surplus amount of resources, valuable resources, especially in places like Congo.
Yeah.
And we see the ways in which U.S. imperialism identifies and changes governments depending on the vulnerability and, of course, of how well the government in power plays for the interests of U.S. imperialism.
Right, and it also determines, you know, if the resources are there, who gets money, who gets aid, what police forces get backing from the West and what don't. One example I can think of is in Nigeria, in the Niger Delta, which is, you know, vastly oil-rich.
Yeah.
All the population around where the oil is, you know, malnourished, no schools, like uneducated, no access to any resource, and Dutch Shell is the main oil company there, which funded death squads that killed you know, a very prominent activist African leader, Ken Sarawiwa, you know, they paid the death squad and they hung him, and they hung eight people, and I mean. So you have a leader trying to take control of, you know, resources and you know, identifies the issue, dead.
Of course. And you know? It's true not only of Africa, but of everywhere that has what's allegedly to be a third world or developing country, Guyana.
Yeah.
I mean, they have so much gold.
Mm-hmm. Ghana. And, Ghana.
Oh, Guyana, sorry.
Ghana.
Ghana is the where he is right now, where Obama is.
Okay, sorry.
Guyana has so much gold.
Yeah.
So much gold, and 90.
How much gold?
Oh, I don't, many.
Yeah.
No, they have so much gold, and of course, 90. Was it 90% of it goes to Canadian banks?
Yeah, Royal Bank.
Royal Bank. Yeah, there's a few. Scotiabank.
Yeah.
And 5% of it goes to the government of Guyana.
Yeah.
And so, what's left for the mass population of, and this is one of the poorest countries in the Caribbean.
Zero.
And when a government, Chetty Jagan, took control and started to sort of nationalize the gold so that the wealth came to turn up. And of course, America, in conjunction with Britain and other nations, took him out of power.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole facade about how, oh, it's 2009 and we don't have a hand in politics out there in Africa or in the Caribbean, and if they're not developing, it's because of their own, I guess, laziness or inability to govern themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, that's not the case. You have Ethiopia has the best coffee in the world, and people are starving.
Yeah, and like, dude, like coffee is one of the most traded commodities in the entire world, right? Tim Hortons is making billions.
Yeah, Nestle. You know? Like,
they're in Times Square.
Yeah.
And what's happening to the coffee bean producer, right?
Yeah.
You don't get squat. That's what happens. So
also, one more thing. I'm not going to get too much into it because we've got a lot of stuff to do. What time is it?
Advertisements.
Oh, yeah. Joe Biden pretty much said that Iran or Israel can bomb Iran. It's if they want to. It's their prerogative.
Yeah.
So I guess any nation can bomb any nation if they want to.
I heard him talking and he's just like, you know, it's not up to the United States to dictate the sovereign will of a government. I was like, what are you ignoring the whole history of the United States? Like, you're in Afghanistan, you're in Iraq, dictating the sovereign will of that country, so
I don't even want to get into U.S. imperialism right now.
Now you've just made me mad. Alright, but we're going to talk about Canadian imperialism, Canadian colonialism, within our own
the continued
country.
Colonialism.
Yeah. Yeah, it's this documentary is
very good.
Absolutely enlightening, and you know, We'll talk about it after. So we're going to go to commercials, maybe a track, and then play it. Commercial time. CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics.
David Chase. You're listening to CHRY 105.5 FM. Broadcasting at 158 watts at 105.5 FM. On the World Wide Web at chry.fm. And on the Rogers Digital Network, channel 945.
But on to more serious things. Residential schools. I would say one of the more unsavory aspects of Canadian history. For the reason that not only did it occur in a way that was genocidal, it's been covered up and concealed by the church in conjunction with the government until very recently, where some money was thrown at people. And the way in which it was done was horrible, because people actually had to sit there and give testimony and prove that they were traumatized by residential schools to get any money, as if throwing money at the problem in of and itself is going to fix it. Yeah. It might help a little bit, but anyways, these were schools that were erected by the church in conjunction with the government. When did this start? Do you remember that started?
I'm not sure the exact date. Late 1800s for sure. Yeah, I know Kevin talked about it. The last one went until 1996.
I think Blue Hills. Yeah. But these schools were engineered to pretty much erase the culture of Indigenous peoples throughout Canada to what they would call modernize. But the way in which they did it was a vicious and disgusting program of not only sort of cultural erasure, but... And not necessarily more importantly, but definitely problematically, physical sexual violence that in the end, and it's the numbers are staggering, 50% of all children who ever went to residential schools died. That's a mortality rate that is higher than every concentration camp in Nazi Germany, with the exception of Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. Which speaks volumes about the history, the bloody history of Canada when it comes to especially something like that.
Yeah, I guess the one thing for me, like, that demonstrates how genocidal these schools were and how implicated Canada is criminally is Canada cannot ratify the fifth part of the Genocide Convention, which explicitly states forced transfer of children away from their parents by a government or, like, a group's children transferred to another group, which are guilty. And there's also, you know, a whole thing about forced sterilization, which I think is the third part. But that's all I'm going to say. I'm going to let Kevin take over. This is an interview that he did recently. Is there anything else you want to add before?
No, I think he'll give a detailed description. We can maybe talk about it later. Yeah. But
so Kevin's a priest, a former priest of the United Church of Canada, which is the Anglican division. And, you know, he's just started... You know, unraveling this this twine that is the genocidal schools, and eventually defrock kicked out, and so on. So, without further ado,
I know a lot of you people out there don't understand, but there is a need for the world to know about this, because the church is hiding and the government's hiding. There is a lot of people that died in those places.
When God is on our side, we can commit any crime. We're absolved individually from that crime by believing that we have a higher sanction. And that's the danger of religion, in that it allows people to do that. It allows them to kill without a shred of conscience.
The church knows where our children are buried. 50,000 died.
In Vancouver, British Columbia, I'm Amanda Bellerby. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Imagine for a moment that your young child goes missing and never comes home. Years pass, and one day the person responsible for your child's murder is identified, but this person evades arrest and imprisonment simply by issuing to you an apology. Imagine that this happened on a massive scale to thousands of parents like you across the country. The federal government, while protecting the murderers, orchestrates phony, nationwide truth and reconciliation events where the death of your child cannot be mentioned. The government offers you $10,000 in hush money, which comes with a gag order that says you can't talk to the media or anyone else about any of it. Now imagine that you're one of the children. You're 6 years old and you're torn from the arms of your sobbing mother by armed thugs, who also happen to be the federal police. They take you away to a prison called a residential school, where you stay for the next 10 years. At school, your language is banned, your culture is called evil, and you and all the other child prisoners are regularly humiliated, beaten, sexually abused, and raped by the adults controlling you. In fact, more than half of your fellow students never even make it out of there alive. They're left to die when they get sick, and no doctor or nurse ever comes to help them. Some of the healthy kids get taken to a hospital where they're experimented on, sterilized, and given traumatizing shock treatments. Some of them never come back. Now imagine that the people doing all of this to you are Christian ministers, priests, and nuns from the Catholic, Anglican, and United Churches of Canada, and that the federal government passed a law to make it all happen. Kevin Annett is a community educator and minister in the downtown Eastside neighborhood of Vancouver, BC. He's the author of Hidden from History, The Canadian Holocaust, and he's also made an astounding award-winning documentary film called Unrepentant, Kevin Annett and Canada's Genocide. He joins me here in the Co-op Radio Studios in downtown Vancouver. Kevin, welcome to Flashpoints and Pacifica Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with the residential schools themselves and how they were created. Can you talk about the Indian Act?
Well, yeah, the Indian Act was brought in Canada in 1874. Native people were actually segregated into a different class of citizenship. So they're actually called the legal wards of the state. And that's still the case in Canada. That's never changed. So if you're a Native person under the Indian Act, it means that you can't act on your own behalf. You're in the same category as if you're a mentally incompetent person or a child. So you can't own property, you can't open a bank account, you can't appear in court on your own behalf. And on the basis of that, basically the government and the churches are able to do whatever they wanted to people legally. Even though they've, as you mentioned, tortured and killed people, they can still define for them what would healing be, what would justice be.
So how did these residential schools get set up, and how was it that parents had to let their children go into these schools?
Well, it was operating all through the 1800s. The Catholic Church especially had these mission schools where they would bring in Native kids and, quote, make them good Christians. And what happened in around 1890 is the Canadian government stepped in and authorized the creation of these schools. So they had government money backing them and legitimacy. All of the churches were involved, all the main Catholic and Protestant churches. So we're talking Anglican, that'd be like the Episcopalian Church in the U.S., the United Methodist, Presbyterian, Catholics, they're all running it. What it was a model that the Catholic Church had used for centuries all over the world, where they went in, they identified the chiefs who could be converted, and they used those chiefs against their own people. And there's stories right here in Vancouver of Chief Capilano, who's a traditional Squamish chief, describes how in the 1920s, the RCMP and the priest went into the longhouse and threw his grandfather out into the snow one night, literally. And they moved in a Catholic native chief. And to this day, the chiefs on the Squamish Reserve are the descendants of the ones that they had parachuted in. So they displaced the traditional chiefs, the clan mothers, and their whole traditional way of thinking and acting and their laws, and they brought in Christian Indians. And that was used as the model for what they did in the residential schools. So in effect, these were like theocratic dictatorships under the control of a priest with government sanction, and basically the churches had absolute carte blanche to do whatever they wanted. The churches were made the legal guardians of these kids in the 1930s. So the native parent had to sign away guardianship rights of their own kids to the church, to the principal of the school. You know, the Indian agent would come around maybe once a year, maybe a couple of times a year, but I've found letters even where Indian agents describe how they had to look the other way when children died. This was run by the church, and they didn't want to, you know, upset the church by looking too deeply into this. So it was officially a jointly run system, but in practice it was completely dominated by the churches, and the principals were invariably clergymen. That's a bit different than what you had in the States. The boarding schools there tended to be run by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and there were some missionaries involved, but they didn't have the kind of power that the churches have and had in Canada.
You say in the film, when God is on our side, we can commit any crime. Can you talk more about that?
Well, it kind of harkens back to what I mentioned about the attitude. It doesn't just start with the Indian Act. It goes back into the whole history of Christianity, or what some call Christendom. The church has the power and the right to conquer anybody in the world who isn't a Christian. And with that attitude of religious imperialism, if you like, anything can be justified. You know, I was raised on the prairies, and I was raised with the attitude, well, the Indians aren't around anymore. They were here once, but they're just not here anymore. And I remember going out to the Calgary Stampede when I was a little kid, and I saw these native guys, and they had cowboy hats on. I said, Mom, those are Indians. And she said, no, they're not. The attitude is, well, they aren't there anymore. They're kind of assimilated in us, and yet you never have one over to dinner. You never, you know, allow your daughter to marry one.
How many kids were affected or sent into these schools?
Well, the government claims 125,000, but that's a very conservative figure, because that is assuming that the children that were brought in were between the ages of 7 and 16, which is what the law required. In fact, from eyewitnesses, we know that the Mounties, the RCMP, would go into villages and just clean them out of all the children, some as young as 2 and 3.
RCMP is the Federal Police Force.
Yeah, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. So you easily have to double that number. I think that we're talking at least 250,000 children. And their own figures show that half of these kids weren't coming back. So we're talking in the tens of thousands of children who died.
And when did they finally shut down?
Well, the last one actually didn't close till 1996. And a lot of them closed in the 1970s. There's people alive my age, even in their 40s, who were in a residential school. In 1 week here, you probably will have 4 or 5 people committing suicide. You'll probably have twice the number of that dying on the street from fights, being beaten to death by police. That happens regularly. You know, this happens not only in Vancouver, but all over the place. Every one of those people, their problems can be traced directly to what went on in the residential school or what happened to their parents and was passed down. You know, as you described so well at the beginning, you had your entire life uprooted as a child in these schools. There's a man down here, Harry Wilson, who was actually in our film. And Harry talked about how they never used painkiller on his teeth. You know, the dentist would come in and just drill on the kids. And a man had told me that occurred to him 20 years before in the same school. So this isn't just some random act of some sadistic guy. This is almost a policy they adopted of how you traumatize people. All of their heads shaved, systematically raped, every single one of them. You know, the use of means to so traumatize the people that they'll do whatever you want. And, you know, clearly when you look how this happened historically and why, it was part of a whole plan, especially here in the West, to depopulate the area quickly and get the lands and resources in one generation. The RCMP were actually created, when you look at their mandate, their mandate was to clear all Native people within 50 miles of the railway. So it shows you kind of the attitude is these people are expendable. They always have been and they still are. But it's an unofficial kind of apartheid.
Let's talk about you, because the way I really want to dive into this reality is through your story, Kevin Annett. I mean, it's a remarkable story. You're very well positioned to be taking on this fight for the people.
Well, like I say, in the 1980s, I was working down here on Hastings Street, out of a United Church, just a block from here, really. And I began to encounter a lot of these problems. Like any non-Native person in the society, I was completely ignorant about the history that had led to this. It's like the whole population is terrorized, and so no one wanted to talk about these things. So after I was ordained, I went to Port Alberni in 1992. And the first time I heard about it, and I described this in the film, I had gone out to a man's house, Danny Gus, who is a retired Native fisherman. And after I had performed a wedding service there, I asked him why there were no Native people in the church, because I'd only been in Port Alberni a month. I got up in the pulpit every Sunday and looked out, and there was this lily white congregation in an area that was one-third Native. I knew that the United Church had had some relationship with the Native people. I didn't know anything about the residential schools. So I just asked Danny why they weren't in church. And he looked at me, you know, like almost insulted. And then he was looking out the window at the old residential school, and he said, my best friend's buried in the hill out there because they killed him in the school, and church people know about it, and they don't want us there. And I invited people to get up on Sundays and just tell their stories, which caused quite a interesting reaction among some of the older white people who would get up and stalk out, because these people were related to the ones who would run the residential school, the old missionary families and that. That, and also having to do a lot of funerals of young Native people, a lot of teenage suicides, started asking people, you know, where is this coming from? Because it's such a huge phenomenon in the Native world. And invariably it was traced back to the fact that their parents, who had gone through the residential schools, didn't know how to be a parent. They didn't know how to love. All they knew how to do was how to hit and abuse their own kids, because that's what had happened to them. when you take away people's identity and their land and their language and take away their family and the love from there, what do you have left? There's nothing left.
My name's Harry Wilson. I went to Port Alberni Residential School 1959 to 1970.
My name's Kenny Quittell.
My name is Virginia Baptiste. I'm from the Osoyoos Indian Band in Oliver, B.C. I went to the residential school. My first year was 1955. I went until 1963.
My name is Harry Lucas. I'm actually 64 years old.
My name is Nankreska. I come from the people of Haida Gwaii.
At age 5, I was kidnapped by terrorists in a gunboat. The RCMP had this boat with a gun mounted on it to gather children from villages.
Everything that I had had a number. It was 54 on there. And if you were caught with somebody else's number, you got whipped for that.
She was standing at the top of the stairs, and he kicked her. She went rolling downstairs. She was laying like this. Her eyes were open, but she wasn't moving. She wasn't crying.
Her name was Maggie. She was 2 years older than me. And she was murdered in there by a nun. She pushed out the window, second story up, and she died. But nothing was done about it. We weren't allowed to see a lawyer or nothing. They just covered this up.
So I gradually began to learn these things. And when I eventually, the church and I parted company, I began to learn even more.
Talk about the first warning signs that you had that all was not going to be well within the church as you started finding these things out and giving people a platform, giving them a place to speak their truth.
Well, it actually happened about 6 months after I started inviting Native people in. I tripled the size of my congregation. We'd really opened up the church to the community. And Fred Bishop, who he's deceased now, he was the chair of my board, and he used to work for the big logging company there, McMillan Bloedel. He came in and had kind of a paternalistic talk with me one day, and he said, you know, Kevin, you better stick to just being a minister, because you're getting involved in some things that are way over your head. You don't really understand the Native people, and I'd be very careful if I were you. What eventually sealed my fate was I found out that the United Church had for a long time been selling off land that they had basically stolen from the various Native tribes, selling it off to various logging companies that were financially contributing to the church, including McMillan Bloedel, which was eventually bought up by this big American multinational, Weyerhaeuser. In fact, it's the biggest logging company in the world. Weyerhaeuser had manipulated this whole thing because they wanted to get into the last of the old-growth cedar trees on Vancouver Island, and the only way they could do that under the NAFTA agreement was not through the Canadian government, but through the Native chiefs. And the Native chiefs got together with the United Church and did a deal where they handed over this land. The United Church policy on Native land claims was we are to return any Native land in our possession to that Native nation. Instead, they flipped it in a little deal to a local businessman who was connected to McMillan Bloedel. And McMillan Bloedel eventually acquired it very cheaply, about $3 million, and they eventually sold it for $75 million. Now, I wrote a letter about that to the church saying, kind of naively, hey, wait a minute, we're not supposed to do this. And within a week, church began to hold secret meetings with my board to have me removed, and that happened soon after that.
Railroading and a processing to get somebody who had far too much information for his own good out of there. He'd stepped on big toes. He'd stepped on moneyed toes. It was terrible. At moments, I really wondered if I were in Guatemala or Mexico rather than this quiet late summer afternoon in this church in downtown Vancouver. I couldn't believe the things I was hearing.
I feel it will remain a very black mark against the United Church of Canada. It was a very disgusting type of procedure. I would call it a witch hunt. A question in my mind as to why a church would be carrying out such an activity. Why they would be spending the money. Reverend Annett was someone who had the trust of the natives, of those underprivileged. And it seemed to me that the church should have been making use of him.
the charges never even got made up. The first I saw of them was late March with a letter that came out in the Courier where suddenly I saw charges listed against Kevin Annett. I mean, this is the kind of nonsense that went on, but very dangerous and very hurtful nonsense.
People who I counted on who would stand by me, they all ran for the hills. I mean, people in the churches, I was pretty much ostracized. And I, you know, speaking of South African apartheid, it's like being a banned person. That's basically the situation I'm in. The media won't cover my stuff. There's all this story out there about how Kevin Annett is crazy and trying to bring down the church and blah, blah, blah. That's so that the people in the wider society never have to look at what I'm talking about, look at the evidence, because it's a way of keeping that evidence delegitimated. You know, it works.
I can't believe what went on there. I think that Jack Bell said it all. He just couldn't stand to watch it. It was obvious that you had stepped on some pretty big toes and that you were going to be slaughtered for it.
That same year, I was actually tossed out of the church. The first of the healing circles were formed here in the downtown east side of residential school people who were suing the United Church. And they knew, actually, my trust level went way up among Native people because I wasn't part of the church anymore. So they began to invite me into these healing circles, asked me to record their stories. And that's how, you know, the process that led to my book and the film actually began about 12 years ago now.
3 years it took me to realize it, though, you know, of torture and pain. You know, I lost my childhood when I first got there and never knew what it was like to have parents. Still hurts. Sorry about that.
It's all right, you don't have to apologize.
I never knew my mother. Still don't today.
It was always hard for us to tell one another we love you. Because we were taught true love was wrong. They told us the love was wrong, that was the devil's work. But yet, these priests and nuns could hug and kiss. And we couldn't even hug our own brothers. We couldn't even hold them and tell them we loved them. It took me a lot of years before I was able to tell my boys I loved them.
I couldn't remember any good times that were there because I was being punished for things I'd never done.
Like what kind of punishment?
Punishment by restraining me to the bed. I had bed problems as wetting the bed, and they would tie me in bed and put an electric underneath my sheet so that when I did wet, I would electrocute myself.
Did they put you in a hospital?
Yes, they did. Well, they gave me some drugs or something like that.
What happened to you when they gave you the drugs?
Put me in like a padded room. Padded room, like? I was strapped down.
That was after you reported the girl?
Yeah.
Finding the girl's body.
Yeah.
I'd seen them burn hands of kids when they're 3 years old and five with a little spike in their hand and like that, like a shock.
Electric shock?
Yeah.
Device? Why did they shock the kids?
Because the kids wouldn't listen to the Catholic priest.
He used it on my brother's penis. He electrocuted his penis there till my brother passed out. And he was laughing, brother. My brother said he was laughing while he was doing it. We'd like to see him in pain, I guess.
Then the police force, I was involved in a few investigations regarding the victims of residential school, where one particular individual had went home in the summer and learned how to speak his own language, and his dad had taught him how to carve. When he went back to school, he continued doing this, speaking his own language and carving. And the teacher caught him and took his knife away and broke his carving up. And he took a pencil and he drove it right through his hand. And you still see the scar where he drove the pencil right through his hand.
Then there was other times where they put us in a tub and then they had a bucket of snakes, you know, them black and yellow snakes. And they'd throw that in the tub while we're having a bath. And the snakes are... they can't stand that hot water. They try and crawl all over our bodies, trying to get away from that hot water. They'd all just curl up because they die immediately. And those are some of the horrifying things that they'd done to us to discipline us to keep quiet.
In Port Alberni, the church hierarchy was lined up with the logging company and the white settlers, if you like. They were continually saying, don't believe these stories. They're making it up. They just hate us because we took away their land. I was told that at every level of the church that all of these stories are lies. Not some of them, but all of them. And that got me wondering, too, the fact that the church would have a defensive reaction like that. When they began to get sued, then the church began to talk about apologies and reconciliation. Well, naturally, because they were afraid of losing their shirt in court.
Tell us just a few of the sorts of stories that you heard from the Native people that came into your church.
Well, one story I remember that really struck me was a woman got up once in church, and I don't know how she found the courage to do that, but she actually named a very prominent man, white man in town, as somebody who had, as a teacher in the residential school, been regularly sodomizing the boys and raping the girls, but he especially went after the boys. He would line them all up, and she said it was like a slave auction. They would be lined up outside, and he'd bring his friends in, and they'd all pick a boy and go off with them. She saw him tie a boy to the end of the bed and sodomize him to death, so he died. And then he was buried in the hill back. And she saw it. She witnessed it for several hours, that happening. And then she was threatened that the same thing would happen to her little brother if she ever told about it. And when she told that, it's kind of like people then have to make a choice. Are you willing to believe that? Because if so, your whole world is going to change. Your whole world is going to end, if you like, because mine did. You have to question, well, how could this be allowed to happen? These aren't random acts. This is being officially engineered and approved from the highest levels of power.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Foster, and you're listening to CHRY 105.5 FM.
How hard can it be to get that P-E-A-C-E? Do I have to get on my knees and start begging, please? Brother, please. I represent for the 90 out of 100 that have not. While you and the 9 others that have got to share the wealth. We're each entitled to a breath until there's some left. The right to live in peace is God-given. There's a will, there's a way, that's how I'm living.
Primo viejo, cantos y textos, mis ojos quietos, libros abiertos, ilusiones sin derechos.
¿Para
que el capital se puede circular entre ellos y no tu pueblo? Esto está hecho de carne y hueso. ¿Qué te cuento? Sigo en eso, sin religión. Quiero pa' no ser capaz de aguantar más represión. Mi decisión, una contribución cultural. Una pa' arriba de Montreal, el bueno y el mal.
I dream of a place free from hate. I dream of a
just a sign, it's a state of mind that rhymes with what's known to mine, which is rightfully yours. The government laws are behind doors, settling wars by trading blood for ore. With nomads and trooping, the city cracks surface like beats in the Sudan. Getting kicked and pushed back from their own lands. My holy hands, not as holy lands, of course, bloody hands. See, it should really be part of the plan, cause what we want is
la paix, c'est ça, c'est comme un besoin. Depuis siècles, la chèche, on marche en trop loin. Trop faillissé, n'est que rien dit un rien. Plus loin, rien, de ton mouvement qui t'aignait. Si c'est pas l'inégalité, vive en sérénité. Assurer sécurité, vive en fraternité. Rejeter matérialiste, jalousie impérialiste. Malpropreté, toujours fait réalité.
Haïti, the right to live in peace, mean freedom. And I, the right to live in peace, mean freedom. Cuba, the right to live in peace, mean freedom. Palestine, the right to live in peace, mean freedom. Israel, the right to live in peace, mean freedom. Chechnya, the right to live in peace, mean freedom.
I dream of a place free from hate. I dream of a place where peace remains. I know life ain't easy, and let the music ease me. Though the state of the world be making me swirl, no man keep on moving.
Ingested impulsive recorder, world infested and boarded, the quest of a martyr with a chest vested this scarred. We confess that we were tested and brought up. Who bleed in need of order like obsessive compulsive disorder. Sufferers, the loving us hovering, bouncing and shoving and covered in houses. Abused spouses, the governing council. Someone's counting bodies, climb time. Start the next revolution, artists blessed. Aurelia, peace,
la planète fleur part à la dérive. À voir qui la délivre. Sur ce radeau, y'a plus de vivre. On conjugue plus le verbe vivre. Les illusions nous maintiennent ivres. télévision grise, on cerveau brûle les pages de tous nos livres. Enfant horrible, enfant horrible, diabolique est le leader du monde libre. Sa tour de magie agite le bâton et pouf, le chat devient tigre. La vague de fatigue et l'impuissance, pas ça, ça me gifle la paix.
All right, CHRY 105.5, we're back. So we were playing, if you tuned in halfway, a documentary or an interview by documentary filmmaker Kevin Annett.
Doctor, isn't he?
Doctor, yeah. He was a former United Church of Canada minister who was defrocked and kicked out.
It's a funny word.
Because he started exposing, you know, the churches, the Canadian state's role in the genocidal residential schools that went from, I don't know the exact beginning date, late 1800s to 1996, you know, 15 years ago. And people are still feeling the legacy. So if the last one closed in 1996, you might have people in their 30s walking around today that, you know, feeling the effects of these schools. There's a prominent, Indigenous scholar Ward Churchill, who, you know, has come under fire for his views, speaking out against not only colonialism of Native peoples, but even, you know, the history of United States foreign policy, the bloodiness, and that could be a whole other show. I'm going to leave it at that. But he wrote a book called "Kill the Indian, Save the Man: The Genocidal Impact of American Indian Residential Schools," which he meticulously documents, you know, the crimes of U.S. and Canada. And what he says is that it has been argued that the rampant sadism marking staff behavior in the residential schools from start to finish derived not from any conscious intent on the part of responsible officials, but inadvertently as a byproduct of some complex of budgetary constraints and other factors that led to endemic student malnutrition, overwork, and lack of Medicare. There is a certain superficial truth to this. Offering bottom dollar for jobs often situated in, quote, remote and backward locations is a sure recipe for attracting the dregs of any mainstream white labor pool, i.e. the misfits, incompetents, and sociopaths deemed unfit to work in any other settings. And it was always implicit that the threshold criteria for employment in the schools was that those hired be white. So what he's saying is that the people that went out there to teach these kids were usually like the lowlifes, unreformed criminals, just a lot of bad people, sociopaths that went there. And, you know, in society, they're the lowest. But when they're put out there in these remote locations with people that are purportedly inferior, right, they're on top. So, and a lot of the crimes came down from that sort of mentality. Like Kevin Annett said, I'm not going to go over it, but it was a long legacy, hundreds of years of brutality and torture, hard labor. Like, a lot of these were like logging camps.
Enforced gender roles?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, right? And, just wrecking, like, generations and generations of a culture, of a society, of passing down knowledge and things like this, right?
I mean, these schools stretched from, yeah, the cultural erasure of their indigenous ways, beliefs. They were beaten. Their tongues were cut off for speaking their native tongue. They were beaten badly. But it all stretched from that up onto physical and sexual violence.
Yeah.
I mean, one gentleman on the radio, one woman actually, was recounting her brother who had his genitalia attached to some sort of electric device.
Yeah.
To a child, yeah, you're going to do such disgusting and despicable things.
Yeah, and the very last part, before we went to break, the person said, like, one minister would line them up like a buffet. How horrid that metaphor is, that's the cold reality. And so, like, one thing that you always hear with, you know, indigenous issues is a defense is that we give them so much money. We pour so much money into them. What people forget is that to call yourself an Indian puts you under the Indian Act of Canada, meaning that you have to be confined to the poorly underfunded malnourished areas of society, which are the reserves, you know, where there's no investment in jobs, you know, conditions there, like, they call them the fourth world. It's not third world quality conditions, it's third world quality within the first world, the so-called first world. You're not allowed to have a bank account.
Not only are the conditions, and I'll let you do. Not only are the conditions so bad to that where War Churchill called it the fourth world, but their land is still being encroached upon almost daily.
Absolutely, yeah. Especially in Alberta with the oil sands, the Lubicon Cree has been fighting. They have, I think, 17,000 violations as of right now.
Caledonia.
Their lawyers. Caledonia is another one. And so the argument in Caledonia is you have one nation, one law, one people under one law. But it's explicit in Canadian government legislation that they're under a different set of laws, the Indian Act, right? So now you have, that's basically the fundamentals of apartheid, when you have two groups living in different laws, you know? And to try and be under one law means you renounce your culture, your history, your identity. Right, so I mean, you can go on and on about this. I'm going to put the whole interview on the internet when we post our websites, which is radioforall.net, and then in the search engine, type in radio basics, two words, and you can find it there. Also, Google Videos has the entire documentary. I think it's called Unrepentant Genocide in Canada.
Yeah, that's what it's called.
Yeah, so. I don't know. Anything else to add?
We have 2 minutes to talk.
Yeah. Well, really, like, you know, I really studied this stuff in my last year of university. Like, you know, residential schools. And it just, like, you know, hit me in the face like a punch. Like, I couldn't believe it, you know. And it just, when you learn about this stuff, you look at Canada differently.
Yeah,
it's almost like you can't legitimize this place. Like, you can't, without, like, fundamental, like, justice and, you know, a whole changing of the social relations, I don't know how it can continue.
Well, it's sort of, we can't talk really about the colonization of indigenous peoples in this land or in the United States or elsewhere as some sort of historical fact.
Yeah.
It's the continued internal colonial program of a government that just does not want to recognize these people as the
well, they can't, you know, it undermines the whole state. I mean, BC right now, where they're having the Olympics, there is no treaty. If you want to say treaties are legitimate, and we're going to go by that, there's no treaty in BC, right? So that not only undermines, like, the treaty process, but just the process of, you know, ownership.
It's
9
o'clock.
It's 9 o'clock. So, that's that. I don't know. Vince isn't here, so, you know what? I'm going to play a track. This is, you know, Santa Gorilla, which is a collective, a music collective, Filipino youth, that played at our Mayday show, you know, a couple months back, that were unbelievable. They're an unbelievable band, and hopefully if they're out there listening, they'll come on. We're going to try and get them on. Yeah, so we'll play this, and, you know, if we don't come back, you know, it's been a lightning show.
Next week.
Yeah, next week. Oh, next week's a big show.
Michael Parenti on.
Michael Parenti, who's just, you know, just a brilliant man, and he's going to come on and talk about this monument that they're putting out in perfect timing, too. Well, capitalism is in its biggest crisis, you know, in almost 100 years. They're going to put out a monument to commemorate the deaths of people from communism.
There's Vince. He's coming into the studio. So play that song.
Okay, so we're going to play this song. Tune in next week for Michael Parenti.
Radio Basics.
Later, people.
Zara Muhammad.